This is Mission to Israel, a broadcast ministry featuring author, teacher, and evangelist Ted R. Weiland. It's our prayer here at Mission to Israel that our time together will inspire you, give you insight into current events, and reveal your place in God's plan. Our address is Mission to Israel, Post Office Box 248, Scottsbluff, Nebraska 69363. Or contact us via the web at www.missiontoisrael.org. And now, here's Ted Weiland.
You might be a Christian if, part six. The text for this series being Isaiah 33:22. For Yahweh is our judge, for Yahweh is our lawgiver, Yahweh is our king, and he will save us. I began the previous message, if you remember, by asking the question, can someone be a Christian and a Democrat, a Republican, a Libertarian, and yes, even a Constitutionalist at the same time? And perhaps that question is comparable to asking, can a person be a lawyer and a Christian at the same time? And you've heard that asked before, and of course, with its general implications, but it's perhaps in the same light that could be asked. In most instances, the two, talking about the lawyers and Christians, when you really understand what lawyers are all about, in most instances, the two are incompatible, at least when it comes to being a Christian in good standing. Is it any different with the former political parties? As I pointed out previously, the principal point of this series is to help us to understand what genuine Christianity is really all about. You know, our desire as Christians should never, never to be satisfied with the status quo of wherever we're at any particular time. We should always be going for that deeper level. You know, Paul or whoever it was that wrote Hebrews, the author of Hebrews, chastised the Christians of that time. He did the same with the Christians for being babies and only wanting the milk of the world, being satisfied, looking for only preachers and teachers that would tickle their ears. And the Hebrews author, he chastised them that they weren't teachers yet and that they still needed just the milk of the word and that they hadn't gone on to the deeper things. That admonition is found time and again in the scriptures, and we need, no matter where we're at, we need to be looking to a deeper level or a higher level, if you will, than where we're at any given time in our life. And I believe this is an opportunity in this series for us hopefully to be able to do that. And again, the whole point of this is to help us to understand, maybe at a higher level than we have before, what real, genuine Christianity is all about. Because it's one thing to claim to be a Christian, and usually something else, altogether different, to really be and live like a Christian. Remember Matthew 7:21-23 and its implications. Just as it's one thing to claim Yahweh Yeshua as your God, King, Judge, Lawgiver, Lord and Savior, and usually something, again, altogether different for him to truly, truly be all of that, those things in our lives. Now, he may be those things, at least some of those things in our lives, to the extent that we understand what that implies and means. But that doesn't mean that he's all of that to us as he intends it to be. And that, again, is why we need to be looking, desiring even more than we understand at any given time, and even though we see him as that in our lives. Keep in mind that most of Christendom, so-called, claims him as Savior. And yet he's not even that to most of Christendom, because they have flat out rejected the biblical plan of salvation. He's not even that to most Christians. As found, the biblical plan of salvation, of course, is found in Mark 16:16, and Acts 2:38, and Acts 22:16, scriptures you're all familiar with, but some on the tape ministry may not be. Now, in the last message, I pointed out that what I believe is a very important point for us to understand. I pointed out that it wasn't so much the golden calf that was the problem for the Israelites when they came out of Egypt, but instead what that calf represented. That is a departure from Yahweh and his laws. It wasn't just they had this calf over here, this object that they had built with their hands. That wasn't the problem. It's what that calf represented a departure from Yahweh and his laws to serve another quote-unquote God of their own making in this case, and his laws, which again the calf simply represented. In reality, now think about this, in reality, idolatry is more about statutes than it is statues. Because keep in mind that idolatry is not simply making graven images. And that's what too many people have limited it to, and they haven't really understood, therefore, what idolatry is all about, what the second commandment really condemns. It's not just about graven images, but bowing down, that is, serving it, or more precisely, whatever we graven in our hearts or with our hands, whatever it represents. If this were not the case, then think about it. If this were not the case, then taking photographs of ourselves and our children, painting panoramic pictures of landscapes, using coins with buffalo heads and eagles on them, and hanging calendars on our walls with pictures of animals or whatever it may be, would be idolatry. Just doing those things would be idolatry, violations of the second commandment. Exodus 20, verse 4, thou shalt not make unto thee any graven image or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above or that is in the earth beneath or that is in the water under the earth. And if that's where the second commandment ended, then all of the former things would be unlawful. You couldn't take a picture of yourself. You couldn't take a picture of your children. You couldn't put a calendar. Those pictures back there on those calendars, that picture of those two cats that Amy takes, that would be idolatry. But idolatry is not so much what we have in our possession, but what we do with what we have in our possession. Verse 5 is the key, where he goes on from what he said in verse 4. He says, thou shalt not bow down thyself to them. No, you shouldn't graven them for the purpose of bowing down to them. Thou shalt not bow down thyself to them, nor serve them. Where real worship is found. The real worship is found in the service to whatever it is you bow down to. For I, Yahweh, thy God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children unto the third and fourth generation of them that hate me. And do not miss the implications of that. That the decisions we make have potential, in fact, probably more than potential, it's going to happen, is going to have, the good or bad, has the potential at least of affecting not just our children, but our children's children and our children's children's children and our children's 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 children, to third and the fourth generation, but also don't miss, and showing mercy unto thousands of them that love me and keep my commandments. But the point being is that you cannot separate verse 5 from verse 4. It's not just the making of those things. It's what we do with those objects that we make. It wasn't so much the calf. It was the party. Pun intended. They did have a party, didn't they? You remember when Moses and Joshua came off the mountain? They were partying. It wasn't the party. You know what? And I suspect that that party resembled a whole lot, or it looked a whole lot like the Democratic and the Republican conventions they have every 4 years. It was the party. It wasn't the calf. It was the party, the political party, probably known as the Bovines, if you will. And its laws that the calf represented, that was the problem. And so it is today with the donkey and the elephant and the Liberty Bell, if that's what it is for the Libertarian Party or whatever it is for them, and the Constitution. It's not the objects themselves that's the problem, that's the sin, but what they represent. That is any departure whatsoever from Yahweh and his laws. As Hosea pointed out, our people's hearts are divided. And that's what's happened. And think about the implication of the word divided. Now, some people's hearts are divided, but not everyone's heart is divided. Some people's hearts are divided. The heathen, the infidel, the non-Christian hearts are not divided. They just serve their gods and whoever they are and do whatever they want to do. Their hearts, that's not who it's talking about. Their hearts are not divided. And some Christians, a remnant of Christians who understand what I'm pointing out in this series, their hearts are not divided. They can say with Isaiah, Yahweh is our king. You know, like they did in the early American Revolution. No king but Jesus, as they put it, or Yeshua. No king but Yahweh. Yahweh is our king. So those who understand what I'm preaching in this series, their hearts aren't divided. So who's left? The infidels, the non-Christians' hearts aren't divided. A remnant of those who understand what I'm talking about, their hearts aren't divided. So who's left? It's the rest of Christendom. Like Hosea said, our people's hearts, or I think he said the people's, but that's what he meant, are divided. Christendom's hearts are divided. It's the vast majority of Christendom's whose hearts are divided because they're serving, really only attempting, to serve two political systems. The kingdom of Yahweh and the Democratic, the Republican, the Libertarian, or even the Constitutional Party. And the reason I say attempting to serve is because two political parties, the reason I say attempting to serve is because man cannot serve two masters. For he'll either hate the one and love the other, or else he will hold to one and despise the other. And the inevitable and tragic consequence of attempting to do so is depicted for us in John 19:14-15, where it says, "And it was the preparation day of the Passover, and about the sixth hour, and he," speaking of Pilate, "saith unto the Judahites, Behold your king, as he traipsed Jesus, Yeshua, out from the praetorium where he had just been nearly beaten to death." He said, "Behold your king." I guess, excuse me, it was before the beating. Later he says, "Behold the man," because they'd already rejected him as king. And he says, "Behold your king." And then it says, "But they cried out, Away with him, away with him. Crucify him. And Pilate saith unto them, Shall I crucify your king?" And indeed he was their king. These weren't Edomites, they were Judahites. And the chief priest answered, "We have no king but Caesar." We have no king but Caesar. That's the tragic and inevitable result, consequence of trying to serve two political systems, trying to serve two masters, two kings, as it were. And don't think that it's any different today, or for us today, who attempt to serve two kings, demonstrated in what laws we choose to keep. Don't forget, sin is a transgression of Yahweh's law, and it was our sins, our transgressions of his law, that put him on the cross, and that cries out that we have or at least in those sins, those transgressions of his law, that we have served, that we have or serve another king. Just as much as those who spoke the words in John 19. You know, if by keeping his laws, thank you. If by keeping his laws, think about this. If by keeping his laws, we demonstrate our love for him, as in John 14, 15 and 1 John 5 and verse 3. What do you think it demonstrates? If keeping his laws demonstrates our love for him, then what do you think it demonstrates when we keep the laws of another king or quote-unquote king or political party? I'll let you answer that question. Let me illustrate it in another way by asking another question. Can someone be a Democrat, a Republican, a Libertarian, or a Constitutionalist without being a Christian? Now, someone may be inclined to answer yes to all of the former except the Constitutional Party. So let's go to the proverbial horse's mouth. Although their webpage has many Christian sounding and Christian statements found therein, remember Matthew 7, 21, many will say to me on that day, Lord, Lord, King, King, but, he says. And although their webpage is full of Christian-sounding statements, you will find nothing that indicates that you must be a Christian to be a member or even a leader of the Constitutional Party. In the party platform, you can read this for yourselves, under the heading Character and Moral Conduct, you will find the following. Quote, public respect and esteem toward public officials has fallen to a shameful level. I'm going to stop here for a minute because I want to make sure it's understood. Again, the whole point of this is not to demean or attack the Constitutional Party, but for us to help us see that deeper, that higher level of understanding. Because so many Christian people would read the platform of this and get excited about it. In fact, I'm going to point out here a little bit later, I've got to be careful. You're going to want to become constitutionalist. Because it sounds so good. The whole point is not to attack the constitutionalist or the constitutional party, but to use this as a means to see a little bit higher. Here's what it says again, under the heading Character and Moral Conduct in their party platform. It says, quote, public respect and esteem toward public officials has fallen to a shameful level. The Constitution Party finds that a cause of this national state of disgrace is the deterioration of personal character among government leaders, exasperated by the lack of public outcry against immoral conduct by public office holders. Our party leaders and public officials must display exemplary qualities of honesty, integrity, reliability, moral uprightness, fidelity, prudence, temperance, justice, fortitude, self-restraint, courage, kindness, and compassion. If they cannot be trusted in private life, neither can they be trusted in public life. It is imperative that members and nominated candidates representing the Constitution Party and its state affiliates recognize the importance of demonstrating good character in their own lives. End of quote. Great. And really, I'm not being sarcastic. Great. But at the same time, note that although they require godly moral character, nothing is said about having to be a Christian. In fact, something I don't have to share here, I won't go there. I'll maybe use it later another time. Nothing is said about having to be Christian, and therefore, someone with the same qualities who's a Buddhist, or a Muslim, or a Hare Krishna, or a Jew, or even an atheist, can therefore be a party leader or public officer in the Constitution Party, according to that criteria found in that section. Moreover, consider the preamble to their platform. Now, catch this. Quote, the Constitution Party gratefully acknowledges the blessing of our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ as creator, preserver, and ruler of the universe and of these United States. We hereby appeal to him for mercy aid, comfort, guidance, and protection of His providence. As we work to restore and preserve these United States, this great nation was founded not by religionists, but by Christians, not on religions, but on the gospel of Jesus Christ. End of quote. Did you catch that? Hey, that really sounds good, doesn't it? And again, if I'm not careful, you're all going to want to become constitutionalists. And so far, so good. In fact, so far, this party is so heads and shoulders above anything else out there that it's just, the others don't even begin to compare to the Constitutional Party. So far. But it reminds me of that fella you've all heard about who once jumped off the 10-story building and about down to the fifth floor as he was headed down. Somebody had their window open and overheard him and heard him say, "So far, so good." Kind of reminds me of that situation. Let's go back and start that last paragraph again and then read on to the end of it. They wrote this: "This great nation was founded not by religionists, but by Christians, not on religions, but on the gospel of Jesus Christ." Now catch this. "For this very reason, peoples of other faiths have been and are afforded asylum, prosperity, and freedom of worship here." End of that quote. What? And I hope that you're as aghast, disturbed, and perturbed by that statement as I am. Let me tell you, the constitutionalists believe in a different gospel than I believe in. And more significantly, they believe in a different gospel than what's found in the Bible. Do you know of any verse that comes even close to saying that the gospel of Christ affords asylum, prosperity, and freedom of worship for other peoples of other faiths? John 14:6 says, where Christ said, Yeshua says unto them, he says, "I am the way, the truth, and the life, and no man comes to the Father but through me." Acts 4:12 says, "Neither is there salvation in any other, for there is no other name under heaven given among men whereby I must be saved." And I'm sure somebody's going to say, well, they weren't saying that salvation can come through anyone else in what they stated. True, but that's the foundation. Let's understand that's the foundation. And then consider 2 John 7-11, though, where John wrote the following. He says, "For many deceivers are entered into the world who confess not that Yeshua the Christ has come into the flesh." Come in the flesh. They're deceivers. If they don't recognize Yahweh, Yeshua, for who he was, for coming in the flesh and his purpose for coming in the flesh. Going on, this is the deceiver and the Antichrist. And don't miss what the Antichrist is. It's a plurality of people that were in existence in John's day and has existed ever since who do not believe in Yeshua the Christ for who he is and what he came to do. Then it goes on, "Look to yourselves that we lose not those things which we have wrought, but that we receive a full reward. Whosoever transgresseth and abideth not in the doctrine of Christ has not God. He that abideth in the doctrine of Christ, he has both the Father and the Son." And then in verse 10 and 11, it says, "And if there come any unto you and bring not this doctrine." Now, there are many in the United States today who, according to the constitutionalists, have been afforded to be able to do so because of Christianity. And yet John writes, "If there come unto any of unto you and bring not this doctrine, receive him not unto your house, neither bid him Godspeed." And verse 11 says, why? "For he that biddeth him Godspeed is a partaker of his evil deeds." And yet the constitutional preamble of their platform says that it's because of the gospel of Christ that you're even able to prosper here. Godspeed. And God says, you do that, and you partake in their evil deeds. And again, I don't mean to sound harsh against the Constitutional Party, but we need to wake up, and we need to start evaluating everything that we are going to participate or get involved with by God and by His laws. By God, for God, and of God. Not for and of and by the people. Furthermore, that statement in the preamble of the Constitutional Party's platform indirectly promotes First and Second Commandment transgressions, which are both punishable by death according to the laws of Yahweh and the gospel of Yeshua the Christ. And if you have a hard time believing the latter part of that, then I suggest that you go and read Paul's statements to Timothy in 1 Timothy chapter 1 and verses 7 through 11, which we're eventually going to get to here, hopefully before this message is out. But consider Luke 19:27. I mean, this comes right from Christ himself, where he said, "But those mine enemies, who would not that I should reign over them, bring hither and slay them before me." Not make it so that they can prosper and have asylum. He says, slay them. Now, that's not talking about any vigilante action like some would maybe want to make of it. It's talking about the commandments, statutes, and judgments under judicial protocol as it should be applied. So, but in light of that, essentially the Constitutional Party is promoting what Yahweh identified as a capital crime. Something so bad that it was a capital crime, and yet they promoted it in their very platform. I assure you, it was not the gospel of Christ that affords people, or afforded people here in the United States, of other faiths, asylum, prosperity, and freedom of worship. That is transgression of the First and Second Commandment, but it was the Constitution of the United States of America that afforded people that right to break the First and Second Commandments. Continuing with her preamble, quote, "The goal of the Constitutional Party is to restore American jurisprudence to its biblical foundations and to limit the federal government to its constitutional boundaries." No, it's not, as I just demonstrated. Only the latter part of that is true, to limit federal government to the constitutional boundaries. That's what the Constitutional Party is about. As for the former part, the goal of the Constitutional Party is to restore American jurisprudence to the biblical foundations. The Constitutional Party doesn't even stand on the First Commandment. In spite of all, they're saying, Lord, Lord, King, King. The fact is, they don't stand on the First Commandment even. Continuing, quote, "The Constitution of the United States provides that no religious test shall ever be required as qualifications to any office or public trust in the United States." Let me stop there for a minute. You think that God doesn't, for his kingdom, his government, doesn't require a religious test? He sure does. So they're teaching, this idea that comes from the Constitution isn't biblical. Continuing, "The Constitution Party supports the original intent of this language. Therefore, the Constitutional Party calls..." Now, here it is. Listen to this. "Therefore, the Constitution Party..." Because it does not require religious tests. You don't have to be a Christian. It will not demand that of you. It says, "Therefore, the Constitutional Party calls on all those who love liberty and value their inherent rights to join with us in the pursuit of these goals and in the restoration of these founding principles," end of quote. And there you have it. Anyone, Christian or otherwise, can be a member of the Constitutional Party. But someone is surely going to be inclined to respond, so what? So what if they want everybody to join with them? So what? Well, here's the point. Government is, or should be, all about establishing Yahweh's kingdom here on earth as it is in heaven. At least it should be for Christians with a biblical worldview. That's what government is all about. Remember, according to Isaiah 9, 6, and 7, the kingdom of Yeshua is equivalent with the government of Yeshua. It's right there. It was a prophecy about Yeshua coming to establish his kingdom, which has already been established. Forget these futurists who still think it's not here yet. I can understand why they think that, but it's not right. It's not biblical, as I pointed out and proved in previous messages. But the fact is, the kingdom of Yeshua, according to Isaiah 9, 6, and 7, is equivalent with the government of Yeshua. And therefore, if non-Christians, think about this, if non-Christians can be Democrats, Republicans, Libertarians, or Constitutionalists in good standing, then those parties must be a departure from the kingdom, from Yahweh's government. Because you can't be a citizen or a member of God's kingdom in good standing without being a Christian. Hopefully you see the point. And furthermore, membership in those parties place Christians in transgression of 2 Corinthians 6:14 through 16, where it says, "Be ye not unequally yoked together." Now, we always apply that to marriage and sometimes to business partnerships. Hadn't we? I mean, one of the most important things you can be involved with is the building of government. Shouldn't it be applied to government, political parties as well? "Be ye not unequally yoked together with unbelievers. For what fellowship has righteousness with unrighteousness? And what communion has light with darkness? And what concord has Christ with Belial? Or what part has he that believeth with an infidel? And what agreement has the temple of God with idols?" And then in continuing verses 17 and 18 it says, "Wherefore come out from them, and be ye separate, saith the Lord, and touch not the unclean thing, and I will receive you, and I will be a father unto you, and ye shall be sons and daughters unto me, saith the Lord Almighty." That's how important it is. Following our own individual and family relationships with Yahweh via Yeshua and his blood atoning sacrifice and resurrection from the grave, there's no pursuit more important than for us to be involved in building corporate relationships with Yahweh. That is Christian government via Yahweh's law. That is his kingdom here and now. That's what he wants. That's the reason he challenges us to be the salt of the earth, to have an effect, to make a difference in every aspect of life. And probably, as I pointed out, particularly as it concerns political life, government, his kingdom. But the fact of the matter is, Christians aren't getting it done. In fact, we're so far removed from getting it done. We're so heavenly minded, we're of no earthly good. We're so future minded, we're of no present good. We're not getting it done. And one of the principal reasons is because we've compromised. Christians have done the compromising, not the non-Christians. Christians have compromised and become unequally yoked with political parties that include both Christians and non-Christians alike. And it's the Christians' worldview that's suffering. They're the ones that have done the compromising. Keep this in mind. The gospel of Christ is time and again identified in the New Testament as the gospel of what? The kingdom. Go look it up. It's not just the gospel of Christ every time. It's the gospel of the kingdom. Let's reinterpret that. It's the gospel of government. How many times do we look at the gospel of Christ like we really should be looking at it? Yes, it has its individual implications, and that's where it must begin with all of us. But Christ says, it's not just the gospel of Christ for you. It's the gospel of the kingdom. The gospel of his government is what it is. And Christ said, the kingdom is about upon you in his day. And it began in Acts chapter 2. In verse 41 or 42. And since then, we've pretty much given it away. He gave it to us, and we said, about like old Esau did with his birthright inheritance. I'll sell it for a bowl of pottage. The fact is, we haven't even got beans for it. We've got nothing for it. Principally because they didn't have to take it from us. We gave it away. Christ was dealing with those. He talks about those who were taking the kingdom by force. Now, the kingdom had to be there. They weren't, by the way, think about it. The kingdom had to be then, and it had to be on the earth. They weren't storming heaven and taking the kingdom from Yahweh. He said they were taking the kingdom by force. At least they had to take it by force then. Christendom can't say that anymore. They haven't having to taken it by force at all. They've given it away on a silver platter. Shame on us. It's identified as the kingdom, or as the gospel of the kingdom of government. And therefore, any departure from preaching his kingdom should be considered preaching another gospel, which should make you think of Galatians. And I want you to turn to this passage. I've quoted most of these to you thus far, but let me go to Galatians chapter 1. The gospel of Christ is the gospel of the kingdom. The gospel of the kingdom is the gospel of his government here on earth as it is in heaven. Thus, any departure from preaching the gospel of his kingdom is a departure from preaching the gospel of Christ. And in Galatians chapter 1, beginning with verse 6, it says, I marvel that you are so soon removed from him that called ye unto the grace of Christ unto another gospel. The gospel of the Republicans, the gospel of the Democrats, the gospel of the Libertarians, and yea, even the gospel of the Constitutionalists, which is not another, but there be some that trouble you and would pervert the gospel of Christ. But though we or an angel from heaven or the Democrats or the Republicans or the Libertarians or the Constitutionalists preach any other gospel of the kingdom, the gospel of his government unto you than that which we have preached unto you, let him be accursed. And he said, therefore, as we said before, so may I now again, if any man preach any other gospel unto you than that ye have received, let him be accursed. That's how serious this is. And that's why even the constitutionalists need to be taken to task for any departure whatsoever from his laws. And I know that these are hard sayings. For some very good people, they're going to be hard sayings for those who hear them. Republicans, too. I mean, they're not just constitutionalists. You know, it should be a little bit clearer to Republicans and Christianity doesn't miss than it is for the constitutionalists to see it. But it's going to be hard. These are hard sayings and difficult for some to accept. But keep in mind Yeshua's declaration in Matthew chapter 7 and verses 13 and 14. Enter by the narrow gate, for the gate is wide. And the way is broad that leads to destruction. And the gate is small and the way is narrow that leads to life. And few are those who find it. Well, this elaboration on last week's opening question, I guarantee you, has taken a lot more time than I initially had anticipated for it. But I felt like it needed to be dealt with because I knew that people would struggle with it, what I said there, about whether you could be one and the same. Are there Christians in those places? Yeah. There are, with what they understand at that time, but we're going for a higher level, and they need to be taught to go to the higher level too, or we're never going to get the kingdom restored to what God intends it to be. And we're just going to keep spiraling down this situation we find ourselves in today. It's not going to get better. It's only going to get worse until we understand what it is that needs to be restored. Not the gospel according to the Constitution, but the gospel according to Christ and his word and his laws. So I hope you see that I felt it was necessary, and God just kept providing more and more for me to put into this. That was the introduction, by the way. We flipped the tape a long time ago. All right, well, I want to see if I still can't get through the rest of this and get back to where we left off in the last message. I not only started with a question in the first of the last message, but I also concluded the last message with a question that, if you remember, I left hanging. Chuck Baldwin's point number 7 declared, quote, you might be a constitutionalist if you believe that federal government has no authority to be involved in education or law enforcement. End of that quote. And I pointed out that you do not need to be a constitutionalist to understand or to figure out that government has no business, no authority in the education of our children. Now, if others want to have them involved with their children, you know, that's their choice, but it certainly has no business in the education of our children. But what about law enforcement? And I left that with you. So what do you think? How many of you say, yay, government does have authority to be involved in law enforcement? How many of you say nay? Okay, got one nayer. How many of you don't want to say or do not know? Well, let the record show for those in the tape and the CD ministry, there were more that didn't want to say or did not know, didn't know how to answer. Well, my answer is a qualified yay, that government does have authority to be involved in law enforcement, provided that we correctly understand government. However, before going there, I need to confess that until reading the Constitutional Party's platform position under the heading crime, that I overlooked a key word in Chuck Baldwin's statement, and that word being federal, and I just didn't catch it. So let me read this section from their platform so you understand really what he was saying. Quote, crime in most cases is to be dealt with by state and local governments. To the degree that the federal government, in its legislation, in its judicial actions, in its regulations, and in its executive branch activities, interferes with the ability of the people in their communities to apprehend, judge, and penalize accused lawbreakers, it bears responsibility for the climate of the crime. Note, let me add this, that just caught this. Note, the lawbreakers are not identified in this, just lawbreakers. Not identified as those who are truly lawbreakers, that can only be described or defined by God's law. So there's a problem there, even there. But it goes on, to apprehend, judge, and penalize accused lawbreakers, it bears responsibility for the climate of crime, which has grown more destructive with each passing year. We favor the right of states and localities to execute criminals convicted of capital crimes and to require restitution for the victims of criminals. End of that quote. Tenth story, about the fifth floor, so far, so good. So far, so good. Next sentence. Federal involvement in state and local criminal justice processes should be limited, which means that they're saying there is a place for it. It should be limited to that which is constitutionally required. End of quote. Notice they go back to the Constitution, not to the Bible. And there is another place where the Constitution itself, not just this party, but the party wants to return to the Constitution, there is another place where the Constitution goes beyond, which is just another way of saying adds to the Bible or the Word of God. That which is not only unnecessary, but is also non-biblical. Furthermore, let's not miss that even today, they say federal government, no, except for where it's very limited. But let's also not miss that even today's, they say, let's go down to state and more local, but even today's state or even more local government, which is more biblical, is not likely to punish crime, real crime. It'll punish other crime, how it sees fit, but it's not likely to punish real crime as Yahweh would have it punished according to his commandments, statutes, and judgments. And neither would the Constitution Party if it were in power. Don't forget that rather than promoting the death penalty for First and Second Commandment violators, it makes room for it. It condones, it grants asylum, and even assists them to prosper under such a system. And do you think they would dare write into their platform that sodomites should be put to death? That they would hold to that? I doubt it. Oh, they would condemn it. But it's one thing to condemn it. It's another thing to apply God's judgments where God says they're to be applied. So even state or even more local government today isn't about to punish crime like it should be punished. And neither would the Constitutional Party in most instances. Now, here's my email response to the second half of Baldwin's point number 7, which is still apropos, even though I initially overlooked the word federal. Here's what I wrote. Quote, you might be a Christian if you believe, according to Romans 13, 3 and 4, and 1 Timothy 1, 8 through 11, that government composed of biblically qualified appointed men do have authority to be involved in law enforcement, that is, the expeditious punishment of criminals, Ecclesiastes chapter 8 and verse 11, who are found guilty by biblical judicial protocol. End of that quote. Now let's go to Romans 13, if you will. Give me an idea how much time I have left. Okay. Let's go to Romans chapter 13 and begin with verse 1. Romans 13, it says, let every soul or every man be subject unto the higher powers, for there is no power but of God. The powers that are ordained of God. Whosoever therefore resisteth the power, resisteth the ordinance of God, and they that resist shall receive to themselves damnation. Now let's pause there for just a moment to point out that these two verses remove from their context, particularly the next two verses. They have to cut it off at verse 2. that these two verses removed from their context are those that are nearly always quoted by modern worship the government Judeo-Christianity that promotes obedience to any and all governments in control at any given time. Those are the two verses they'll always go to. But let's think about this for a minute. Something that I don't think I even included in my commentary on these seven verses in Christian Duty Under Corrupt Government. Think about this. Verse 2 ends by saying that Christians who resist the type of government described in those two verses will be damned. Condemned. King James word for condemned. Verse 2 again. Whosoever therefore resisteth this power ordained of Yahweh, resisteth the ordinances of God, and they that resist shall receive to themselves damnation. Speaking to Christians. Now, do you really think that Yahweh is going to condemn or damn those who resisted communism? Or Nazism? Or those today who are resisting the modern day, some of the regimes in Africa? You think God's going to damn them, condemn them? Did Yahweh damn the midwives who resisted Pharaoh? Or Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego who resisted Nebuchadnezzar and Darius? Or the apostles and the first century disciples who resisted the Neros? I mean, common sense here. Do you think God's going to damn those people, especially after he blessed some of them for what they did? Furthermore, when properly translated and understood, 1 Peter 5, 8, and 9 commands us to resist such devils, such wicked rulers, such wicked governments. Now, obviously, common sense alone, and more importantly, the Bible time and again dictates that Paul was not writing about any and every government in force at any given time. You ought to read Adam Clark's commentary. And I'd come to this conclusion before reading Adam Clark's commentary that Paul wrote it as he did because lives were at danger with what he was writing. He had to kind of couch it in such a way that the government may not pick up on what he was really saying. But he certainly was not writing about any and every government in force at any given time. And let me assure you, the next two verses alone categorically prove it. Verses continuing, verses 3 and 4. For rulers are not a terror to good works, but to the evil. Wilt thou then not be afraid of the power? Do that which is good, and thou shalt have praise of the same. Verse 4. For he is a minister of God to thee for good. That doesn't describe today's government. Not that there are incidents where today's government may not qualify that. But as a whole, that doesn't describe today's government or hardly any other governments today. And the majority throughout all of the centuries. Only Christian governments established upon and enforcing the laws of Yahweh. That's the only government that those two verses can be described as ministers of God to us for good. Do you think communism can be described as such? Not